this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, and I always say so, I'm not going to be an egomaniac. The intelligence comes not from me, but from my guest. And in this case, it's dramatically true. Judith Ehrlich is a terrific filmmaker, documentary film. And one her earliest film that I know of was called The Most Dangerous Man in America, a film about Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And it's a film you should see right now, but that's not the film we're here to talk about. But Whistleblower, Julian Assange is in jail. Edward Snowden is still on the lam in Russia. And Daniel Ellsberg always said that, you know, when he faced, 115 years in jail, he thought for his example, others would follow. Well, not too many followed. And however, The Most Dangerous Man in America and Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers showed us that the people who didn't want to go fight in Vietnam and oppose the war, of course, right. And people in Washington and the Pentagon and the White House knew it at the time. And this movie that you've made, and it's, you know, 50 years later, The Boys Who Said No, Draft Resistance and the Vietnam War. And for young people now, and I teach a lot of them at USC and everything, we don't have a draft. War is a video game. You're not going to be called up. If somebody does go into the Army, they see it as a career choice and so forth. I'm not going to deny they may have patriotic motivations or what have you. But nonetheless, this was a time when everybody who didn't have some obvious medical excuse and who was male was going to go. And, you know, I was in that situation myself for some time. And so this is a movie about people who said no and really suffered. Many of them went to jail. So why don't you lay out what the film is about? It's about a great historical moment in America. And why is it so late in coming to us?
Hi, Bob. Thanks for inviting me. Well, the film is really about a very specific slice of what happened during the Vietnam War and the anti-war movement. It's about the people who were facing the draft and were willing to stand up publicly and refuse induction and knowing they would face prison for that move. Over 4,000 of them did actually serve time in prison, but what they did, what they planned to do and actually succeeded in doing through civil disobedience and creating a mass movement behind them that was of tens of hundreds of thousands of people who refused induction, was that they basically shut down the court system, and the courts no longer could process all the people who were resisting, and they ended up just having to end the draft. And it never has come back in all these years. But one little contemporary edge to this is that we've had registration since 1980 came back. In 1980, young people have had to register, young men have had to register. But as of probably next month, if not within before the end of the year, young women are going to have to register too for the first time in history. So women are going to be affected by the draft, which is sort of an interesting historical moment on that issue, which we're facing right now.
Well, but let's get, you know, I did a podcast with David Harris, who had been the president of the student body at Stanford when he got involved in the resistance, and he went to prison, I believe, for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And you have a screening of this movie, The Boys Who Said No, a launch, virtual, October 15th to 17th. And I believe David Harris and Joan Baez, who he had been married to during that period, and Daniel Ellsberg are all going to be part of your program. So, you know, somehow or other, you might mention when and what, and then we can also put that up on the websites that carry this show. But to my mind, the reason this is such an incredible moment in history is that you had, as you said, hundreds of thousands of people willing to really risk prison. Now, we have the civil rights movement. We had war resistance. We had a lot. We had people who have done that. And here were people who were coming from a more comfortable, you know, many of them were white, and many of them came from the middle class and so forth. And they were willing to risk, you know, hard time and do that. And the film captures that. You know, this was heroism on a level that maybe we can't even comprehend now. And you know, the whole idea of don't sell out, stand for something, your life has to be mean, and that you're not willing to go in and be killed possibly and kill others mm-hmm. for a war that you don't believe in. That's what this movie is really all about, is it not?
That is exactly what it's about. And it's about the whole, I think that we forget that it actually takes one person standing up to start a movement. And it's this film really, I think, captures that sense that each individual really does have a decision to make about how they're going to lead their life and what they're willing to do and how much sacrifice they're willing to make once they decide they have some principles they're not willing to compromise. So, I mean, I think that what's facing young people today with climate change and Black Lives Matter and the movements that are happening now are very similar in terms of really challenging their willingness to stand up. And certainly there is a movement that is, you know, stepping into place. But this film really does focus on this movement, which started very small. It was, you know, a few people at Stanford and at Berkeley who just stood up, David Harris and his cohorts, and were willing to really challenge the position of the government and say, you know, our bodies are not for your taking, we're not willing to be drafted into your army, and we're not willing to fight and kill for your really immoral war. So I think we do try to really set the stage for why people consider this war immoral. Also, the thing that I think is unique about this film in some ways is we really make the link between the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement, which I don't think had been clearly laid out before so much. The leadership of this resistance, as it was called, movement, many of them had gone south to register voters in the early 60s. They had been part of the Freedom School movement and really were influenced and inspired by the civil rights movement. Joan Baez, who's a major character in the film, was very close to Martin Luther King and had been very involved with him and would show up and sing. And she was, you know, the diva of the folk music scene at the time and could draw a crowd and protect him in times when it looked really dangerous. She would go down and volunteer to march with King and protect him and his cohorts. So there's that. And then David and Joan meet. I like putting a little love story in my political stories. There was Dan and Patricia and The Most Dangerous Man, and I've got Joan and David in this film. But they end up, she's pregnant when he goes to prison, and their son Gabrielle is married, born while David is in prison. And they make the cover of Look magazine at the time, which was a very big deal as their little family unit in prison. I think got the attention of the country in an unusual way because they were so outside the mainstream, but I think it did legitimize that position of being a war resister. And
people need to be reminded what was at stake here, because there were people who didn't want to go fight, but they would maybe leave the country or find a way of avoiding it. And I'm not putting them down at all. But these were people, and David Harris deserves a lot of credit for defining the message so explicitly, that said, no, we think the war is immoral, and we're not going to participate. And we're here. We're here, and you're going to have to take us through the courts. And, you know, we're going to try to make our case. And I don't know that anything of that kind has happened for basically white middle-class people. We know in the civil rights movement, for both white and black and anybody else who was supporting it, there was that kind of test, because you're in the South, you had brutal sheriffs and, you know, policing agencies of every kind that would threaten your life, and both legally and by lynching. But this was, you know, in Stanford is a very good example. You're asking a young person who's kind of got it made, going to Stanford and even going to Berkeley in those days, and you're saying to them, look, we want you front and center to say, I don't believe in this war, and I'm not going to give you my body or my mind, and, you know, I'm going to go serve time in prison, and which, you know, was not going to be pleasant. And, you know, I myself at the time was editor of Ramparts Magazine, or one of the editors, I don't forget which year, whether I was managing editor or editor-in-chief. But we burned our draft cards on the cover. But, you know, people could say, well, but were they really going to get you? And, you know, well, we did. We had to face U.S. attorney. But you know, the fact of the matter is these were young people who didn't have a lot of lawyering, and they were doing it. They were just doing the right thing. And that's something that has been lost about our history. And that, to my mind, is what made this period of the 60s so special. Yes, there was great wild music. Yes, there was experimentation with one's life. But the willingness first of people in the civil rights movement and then in the anti-war movement to say, no, my body is not yours for war crimes or racism. Mm-hmm. I think we've lost a lot of that. I don't want to bum people out. But, you know, that's different than saying I'm going to save my diet to help the environment. It's also different from isolated cases of people doing very brave things and strapping themselves to a tree that's going to be cut down or something. This was a mass movement that denied the moral authority of this ostensible democracy.
No, I think you're extremely correct in all that. And so when you burnt your draft cards, did you all face legal charges for that? I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, we were dragged before the U.S. attorney in New York. And in fact, I believe it was Cy Vance's, Vance's father.
Oh, really?
You know, it was not fun. I'm not going to make light of it. But we had well-known attorneys, and also we had freedom of the press on our side.
Yeah.
We were, you know, burning our draft card, question we weren't saying, I guess we were saying, but they didn't want to have that test.
Yeah,
it was unnerving, but I don't want to take away from the largely anonymous group of people that we're talking about here.
Yes.
And they aren't just the David Harris's, of people whose lives got messed up, you know, who, you know, I know Bob Zarr, for instance, who's been a big booster of your making this movie, who lives here in Los Angeles. You know, it affected his life. You know, it tore people's lives apart. And I want to get back to the main thing. The reason I want to show this film in schools and everywhere is because it's about integrity.
Mm-hmm.
It's about integrity, and it's about whether we've lost that sense of integrity. And I agree with your point about Martin Luther King. It was very much inspired by the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And the peace movement. You know, after all, Martin Luther King was the one who embraced the peace movement. And his speech at Riverside Church, he just said that my government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. And
yeah,
he joined the civil rights movement with the peace movement. And yes, there was no question the example of the civil rights movement framed this. But it meant for a privileged person like David Harris and many others who we don't know their names to step up and say, hey, I'm going to do the same. I'm not going along. And maybe you're not going to lynch me off a tree in Mississippi, but if you throw me into a federal prison, that's pretty bad.
Yep.
You know, for a couple of years, that's pretty bad.
I think the thing that the distinction of this group versus the mass anti-war movement is that they weren't just talking about being thrown in jail for a few days or, you know, a couple of weeks at Santa Rita, as people were, including Joan Baez. They were signing up for 5 years in prison. And they were willing to do that, and they didn't try to get out of it. So, you know, they were basically saying, put me in prison and, you know, let's see what happens then in terms of this draft. Because I think the government responded to that level of courage, you know, that they really couldn't. It was hard to put that down, people that were really willing to do that, to make that kind of sacrifice. You don't see that often. And, you know, when you brought up the whistleblowers, and because I've made films about whistleblowers and making another one now about a whistleblower in Iceland, but Snowden, Edward Snowden actually has publicly said a number of times that he did what he did because of seeing our film about Dan Ellsberg, which is something I'm really proud of. But I think that the idea of film being a way that inspires people to actually do something, not just go, well, that was nice and interesting. But I think there is something in this film as well that really ask people to question their own conscience and see, you know, we just approved or about to approve the biggest military budget in history. And we've got a democratic government that should be lowering the threshold here. And yet it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we have this enormous nuclear arsenal, which Dan Ellsberg has stood up against time and time again, and working very hard to try to stop the threat of nuclear war, which is hanging over our heads and we don't look at it. You know, so I think that there's lots of issues out there that people need to challenge and that people need to be aware of, whether it's the draft or, well, it's not the draft now, but it's registration for the draft and the militarization of our society and of our government.
Time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest. The point is, and people should ponder it, and when they watch this movie, the movie is called The Boys Who Said No, Draft Resistance in the Vietnam War, is to ask them, where do we get a moral code, moral fiber, if we aren't put at risk? And what the lesson for the people who have power in this country of the Vietnam protest, and in large measure, this movement of people who said, we're not going with your draft and we will take 5 years in jail. That was really sobering. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is they redefined war. They made war into a video game. They made war into a career opportunity. Mm-hmm. They changed. So they would not face this situation. They use other people to make mm-hmm. wars. They have mm-hmm. surrogates mm-hmm. and so forth. And so they've kept the business end of war because now it's very high tech and you need a lot of fancy equipment. And now we're in an odd moment where, okay, but we need an enemy. And so they keep searching for enemies. And now the betting is, will it be Russia or be China? Russia seems a little old-fashioned. They got an economy that's kind of collapsing. China looks better, right? But if you do China, what do you do to Amazon's business model? What do you do to, you know, Walgreens and Costco and all these places that sell primarily goods made in China? And I just saw a poll, AP NORC poll, that said 90% of the people in America, I may have the figure slightly off, but it was around 90%, are worried about China and Russia being great threats to our cybersecurity. We don't even examine what cyber, not the NSA, not the CIA, not anybody, which have the most advanced invasion of cybersecurity and do it everywhere in the world. But okay, China, Russia, two very dissimilar countries at this point. Russia is run by people who are deliberately anti-communist. China is still run by people who claim to be communist, but that doesn't matter. You know, in the Orwellian sense, you have to have an enemy. And people are willing to accept that as long as they don't have to put their lives on the line to fight that enemy. Yeah. And that, again, fits into the Orwellian model. Your enemy could be a fantasy. It's just a thing out there. You invent it. You change the names of it, as he did in 1984. And they've sort of responded to the issue discussed in your movie, that suddenly there was a movement. And I think this is why we had change on civil rights, at least visible change, and the old South collapse. Because the civil rights movement said, we're going to put our bodies in a line, we're going to end segregation. And in effect, that worked. Mm-hmm. However, they came up with alternative models of keeping people down. And the movie, your movie is really about a very successful anti-war, maybe the most successful anti-war movement that we've ever experienced. I mean, it really brought that war to an end, the Vietnam War. But unfortunately, we've been in very long wars since then. Yes. They make no more sense than Vietnam. And yet we've done it without a draft. And that's the kind of sad irony of your movie, isn't it?
Yes, because in the technological warfare that we're now seeing, we don't really need a draft. We don't need hundreds of thousands of soldiers out there. We need drones and weapons and people that are robots to do the warfare instead of needing masses of soldiers lined up on a mountainside. It's just not going to be that kind of war again, and need the manpower and the woman power hour that we, you know, that we have needed in the past. So that those days are over. But the whole question of, I think your point is well taken about the economics of war too. You know, we're going to have to make some choices that have economic repercussions for the country. And I think that's really, you know, are we willing to give up our Walmart shopping so that we can, you know, come to some terms with the kind of world we want to see? And I think those are all issues that are going to be facing us. But in terms of weaponry, in terms of what, I just wanted to get back to the one thing that I think is important about the film and the people who it's about, is that this was a youth-led movement. It was started by Christopher Colorado Jones, who was the original producer who tragically died in an accident a year before the film came out. He was 17 when he stood up and refused to register for the draft. And he organized other non-registrants who were under 18 and were unwilling to register at all. And David and all his, and his cohorts were probably about 18, 19 or 20 at the time. The movement was run by very young people, and they actually, in terms of success, it's the only time really that a mass movement like that changed policy in the United States and ended the draft, which was a major change. And so I think they can really point to having a very successful mass movement of civil disobedience and noncompliance that was run by young people.
Talk a little bit in the time we have left of the people we meet in this movie, yeah. Because, you know, as I say, I noticed Bob Zahr, and he's a great guy here, lives in Los Angeles, and he kept trying to get me to watch the movie, and I kept saying, yeah. And then finally I watched it. And the power of the movie is you face yourself in this movie. Mm. Would you have risked 5 years? Would you, and now we can make it both men and women, because, you know, then it was men, but now we have a draft that can apply, will apply to women as well. You know, would you stand up? And mm-hmm. And it was a visceral decision. You know, you were going to go to basic training. You were going to learn to use your gun, and you were going to learn to kill people. And yet you could be killed. And, you know, the American casualties were real, you know, the 59,000 deaths and many more injured. And so the movie really gets into that psychology. And I think it kind of belittles it to talk too much about Joan Baez, who I think was extremely brave. I'm not taking anything away from her. And the fact that she was married to David Harris certainly helped a lot. You know, David Harris also had been the student body president of Stanford, and he, you know, was an articulate and appealing guy. I'm not taking anything away from them. But most of this movement were people who were not going to get their 15 minutes of fame. And they were going to suffer in prison, probably with not many visitors,
yep.
And not much recognition. And your movie introduces us to those people.
Yes, good point. I mean, I think that, yeah, sometimes, you know, it's nice to have a little star power to get some interest, but it is a film about anonymous people who never would have been known and who have, you know, this started with a reunion of 70 of the people who had been to prison or, you know, them and their partners, et cetera. I just went along to do the interviews, and this was almost 10 years ago. And I just went along to do the interviews. And then it evolved over time into, because Christopher Colorado Jones was so intent on getting this made into a film, it just, you know, was going to be a document of this event. And then it just, the stories were so amazing, and the courage of these people, and the fact that they never wavered. I mean, here it is 50 years later, 60 years later, and they're still totally committed to the position they had then. So I thought that inspired me, and I was really wanted to tell their story. There's some great characters. Todd Friend is one of my favorites. He owned the Tamales Bay Oyster Company and was a rough and tumble guy who served another prison sentence after the one for war resistance because he turned into a, left the country and started sailing boats with drugs on them around the Panama Canal and got caught. Anyway, but he was a brilliant guy, and he died tragically not long after I interviewed him, and slipped off his boat into Malas Bay. But he opens and closes the film, really articulate, really heartful guy who served a very hard time. I served more than 5 years in prison. And there's also Bob Cooney, who's a historian and a fabulous human being. Actually, I gotta say they're all pretty much fabulous human beings. Lee Swenson, who was worked with Joan at the Center for the Study of Nonviolence, and Dan Ellsberg, who was inspired to leak the Pentagon Papers because of his acquaintance with Randy Keeler, who was a war resister who went to prison and was a leader in the movement. And also Bob Eaton, who went on to win the Nobel Prize with other people for anti-landmine work. And so many of these people have gone on to spend their lives doing nonviolence training, nonviolence activity, and just, you know, spending their lives doing good, useful work for the community. And so it didn't end with their prison sentence. They didn't walk away angry and unhappy about having done what they did, but really enlivened by what they did. And those prison sentences didn't stop them from being the people they had gone in being and came out with even more conviction.
You know, the interesting thing about this movie, and I really urge people to watch it. By the way, how do they watch it?
Oh, well, we're having this special gala online launch in the times of COVID. There's so many new ways to look at films. But the 17th of October, there'll be this gala at 5 o'clock Pacific time. And for the 2 days preceding that, there'll be an opportunity to watch the film online. I think the best thing is just to go to Boys Who Said No, www.boyswhosaidno.com, and that'll lead you to buying a ticket for that. Big joining
Boys
us.
Boyswhosaidno.com. Boys Who Said No. Everybody write that down. But let me tell you, this is a movie to, depending on your age, to show your child, your son, your daughter, your grandchildren, whoever you are, or your friends, because it really raises a fundamental question of ethics. What do we have ownership? What are we responsible for? What defines us? And you know, the movie we first talked about, Daniel Ellsberg, the most dangerous man in America. Well, Daniel Ellsberg became the most dangerous man in America because the establishment said, revealing the truth and a history conducted internally in the Pentagon of the Vietnam War would deny the value and importance of the war. And as you said, Daniel Ellsberg has pointed out, it was the witness of young people not going along. Daniel Ellsberg said, if these people are willing to risk prison, and I know about this document that tells the truth called the Pentagon Papers, and I don't reveal it, then who am I? What am I? And unfortunately, there have been very few Daniel Ellsbergs. You know, now recently we've had the Edward Snowdens, you know, we did have, as you mentioned, in the civil rights movement, quite a few heroic people. But really, this movie begs a question. Where are the rest of us? Where are the rest of us? And why don't we take the stand? And when will we take the stand? You had Bradley Manning, you know, here, a young person in the military, now Chelsea Manning, who saw war crimes. Witness war crimes and release the evidence of the war crimes, you know, and release it to Julian Assange. And Chelsea Manning has had her life made miserable by the public authorities because she won't turn in Julian Assange. And Julian Assange is sitting now in prison. Where are the human rights organizations? Where is the outrage that now a Democrat, we can't blame this on Trump, now a Democratic president is trying to get the Brits to turn over Julian Assange. What? For his crime? For doing what Daniel Ellsberg did, for telling us the truth about war crimes. And so your movie really puts us all on the spot. It says, you know, if the boys who said no could say that and go to jail for 5 years, prison for 5 years, what would I do? And what am I doing now? Mm-hmm. What are we doing now? Yeah. That, to my mind, is the educational power of this film, The Boys Who Said No, directed by Judith Ehrlich. And by the way, you were an Oscar-nominated person and an Emmy, I guess, nominated person for the most dangerous man in America, and you won Peabody Award, so you're a very successful filmmaker. And I think it's really to your credit that you are reviving this episode of American history that almost no one knows anything about. It's been buried. Okay.
Thank you.
I think I suspect many people even listening to the show don't know this, that this was the movement that stopped the Vietnam War. We got about another minute here. Do you want to close it with something, a play or what?
I'm just thinking it contributed to ending the war, it ended the draft. But I just think that it's, you know, we need these kinds of films just to, for ourselves to sort of think about where we stand, as you put very articulately, where we stand in relation to the our own conscience and our own ability to make change and what we're willing to sacrifice. And it may be very little, but even a little helps if millions of people do it. So I think that it's important for us all to sort of see how far we're willing to go.
It defines our own humanity.
Yes.
But that's all we got. That we're going to find out about this movie, October 17th. Go to the website, Boys Who Said No. Check it out and get other people, you know, just as a self-education.
Yeah.
Where what you have done, what did you do? I want to thank. Then we're going to conclude this now. Do you want to say a last thing?
I just want to say we will be, we're looking for a broadcast outlet. It's going to be on with Bullfrog Films for educational sales soon. And so schools will be able to get it that way. And yeah, and community screenings through Bullfrog. So if your organization wants to rent the film and show it to your gang, that would be wonderful. So we're hoping there'll be a lot of
class. It'll have to be a
and your class.
Okay.
Thank
the Boys Who Said No. I want to thank you, Judith Ehrlich, very distinguished filmmaker, successful. Christopher Ho at KCRW, who posts our podcast on that terrific NPR station here in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Get your local station to put it up. Joshua Shear, who is our producer, executive producer of Shear Intelligence, Natasha Hakimi Zapata, who writes the really terrific intros. I hope people go on and listen to the show, but the intros are great. Lucy Berber, who does our transcription, and the JWK Foundation, name of a fiercely independent journalist, Gene Stein, who helps with the funding for these shows. See you next week with another edition of Sheer Intelligence.
Non, je ne regrette rien. C'est payé.